This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's time to check in on the health of the Northwest Indiana economy. And we know from time to time, all the data gets crunched at IU Northwest in Gary. And Professor Mike Apollick does, and his staff and helpers do that. We're talking, of course, about the Northwest Indiana Coincident Index and what is called the Northwest Indiana Imputed Gross Metropolitan Product. Sounds very wonky, and so we have to turn to the experts to de-wonk it for it. Micah, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Oh, thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, let's do the definitions first here. We've talked before many times about the Coincident Index. Let's talk about that and what this other GMP, I guess, if you want to call it that, is all about there, too. Give us some definitions before we get into how the numbers shape up here.
Absolutely. So the Northwest Indiana Coincident Economic Index is a simple measure of the health of the economy in Northwest Indiana. The idea was we wanted to distill down a lot of information from a lot of variables to a single number. So our most recent estimate was in December, was 143.5, which is up from 140.2 from 1 year ago. So mm-hmm. It's a very simple way to look at one number that tells you how the economy is going. And then we wanted to make it even simpler. So some of you may be familiar with the gross domestic product, which is a measure of economic output and income. And so we developed a similar version for Northwest Indiana. So rather than, you know, a specific number that, you know, has no units attached, you know, what does 143.5 really mean? We can translate that into economic output in dollars. And so the last quarter of 2018, Northwest Indiana's economic output was $30.8 billion, which is, you know, the first time we crossed the $30 billion threshold, which is pretty exciting for us.
Yeah.
And, you know, we always are a little, you know, careful with these numbers because they are imputed, which means that, you know, we're not on the ground asking, you know, businesses to estimate their incomes and things like that. And so, we have to feel cautious that we're doing a good job. And the BLS actually just released last month, I'm really excited about it, GDP per county for all of the United States, and so we can actually compare and kind of cross-check our numbers with theirs. Theirs only go through 2015, but if we go back and look at what we've estimated for 2015 and what, you know, the BLS estimates, we're within 0.2%. So we're
wow.
pretty happy about that.
That's very good. Yeah, you always kind of wonder whether your data is going to jive with, especially the master list, if you want to call it that, from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, to be sure. And we should mention too that this figure that you just mentioned here about the gross metropolitan product, that $30.8 billion in the output for the fourth quarter of this past year, is more than double where it was, I guess, at that point back in 2017, right?
So back in, through 2017, we've had only, it's not double, you know, we've had 2.3% growth since 2017. So that's like the annual economic growth. Indiana had 6.1% and the U.S. had 5.9%. So, you know, we're growing much slower than the state of Indiana, the United States as a whole, but much faster than we previously have. So typically we grow about 1% a year here in Northwest Indiana, but we did more than double that in terms of growth, yeah, last year. So in that sense, yeah, it is double.
That's good. That's good. Now, I know recently you had a chance to make a presentation on these figures and just the general recent economic trends for Northwest Indiana. And you mentioned in some of that, and you can go into more detail. We've kind of alluded to it because we mentioned about how these fourth quarter figures have shown up so well that basically the Northwest Indiana economy did exceptionally well back in 2018. Tell us more about that and what some of the key reasons that it does show some improvement.
Sure. So the really big one is steel production. So in 2018, we were up about 14% in terms of steel production from 1 year ago. This is the highest level since we've had in 2008. And so, you know, that's an important industry for Northwest Indiana, employs about 6% of all workers and generates about 12% of all earnings in Northwest Indiana. Prices have gone up about 11% for steel, mainly due to the tariffs. And so in the short term, at least, the tariffs have been very beneficial for the steel industry. Profits are up, and some of the recent contract negotiations have resulted in some of those profits being passed on to workers. So some of that, gain in profits is actually going to the hands of workers who are then spending that money in our local economy. And so that's by far one of the biggest factors. I do want to say we have to be a little careful because this is very much in the short term. In the long term, there's a whole other can of worms that we can open when it comes to tariffs and trade wars, but certainly in the last year or so, steel production has been a big boost to the economy here.
Yeah, we'll get into your little forecast, I guess, for 2019, and isn't all as promising as the figures in 2018 show, too. But does it also seem, too, that in 2018 we not only had the improvement in these various sectors, did our employment situation change any?
Yeah, so employment is continuing to creep up slowly. I will say a lot of employment kind of historically has been in the service sector in Northwest Indiana. We're slowly transitioning from more of a goods-producing region to a service-providing region, which is consistent with what's happening nationwide. I will say last year we actually made quite a bit of gains in goods-producing jobs, so manufacturing jobs have started to make a little bit of a comeback here. But we still have about 15% of all of Northwest Indiana is employed in retail trades. And so that, you know, retail sales have actually risen about 5% from a year ago. So that has helped kind of boost the retail industry here, which in turn has helped especially a lot of the middle and kind of lower income workers, you know, get more hours and get more income there as well.
Now, I know that he refers to it on a more statewide basis, but Governor Eric Holcomb has talked about trying to make improvements overall in workforce development and trying to make it so that the opportunity to give people a chance to learn to be able to, in turn, earn more money in a good-paying job is really part of the goal. And I know that that's going to come up again, too, I'm sure, when the governor gets a chance to review whatever the legislature kicks out for the budget that they're working on right now for the next 2 years. Does it still seem to be the case that, as the governor said, he's pushing hard to make sure that the workplace is a better place to be, and that's in turn going to, for us here in Northwest Indiana at least, mean we'll see eventually maybe some more, if not construction-related or production-related jobs even, but high-tech-related jobs too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, if you've been in Northwest Indiana's economy long enough, we tend to have a very backward-looking view. We look back to the good times when, you know, steel was, you know, dominant here in Northwest Indiana. It was the biggest provider of jobs. And, you know, we still kind of wish we were, you know, able to kind of continue that trend. But the future jobs that are going to come to Northwest Indiana that exist in the United States are going to require more education. They're going to be more technically challenging. You're going to require more skills. And so we need to kind of prepare our workforce for that with better education, you know, better training programs, and ultimately be willing to bring in more jobs than just traditional manufacturing and steel. That will always be, you know, the backbone of the region, and it's always going to be absolutely critical. But, you know, the future has to look towards, you know, new opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about, I guess, looking ahead to how we're going to fare for the rest of this year, for 2019, and the data that you have that comes together from the indexes don't always show some promising news. Tell us what seems to be this rather pessimistic forecast, what it's all about, and why hopefully it will not turn out as well as, or worse, as we should say, as it seems to be.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. So last year, 2.3% growth was kind of a blockbuster year for us. Again, more than double the growth rates we've had in the previous 2 years. The forecast for next year is just a hair above 0%, and that doesn't mean that we think it's most likely that we'll grow at 0%. What it really reflects is there's a huge range of potential outcomes. There's so much stuff going on right now, the long-term effects of the tariff and the trade war. You know, the stock market has been extremely volatile. The Federal Reserve is changing interest rate policies, not to mention all the political instability going on. And so a lot of the kind of forward-looking indices and variables that we look at, the leading indicators, are fluctuating up and down kind of week to week, month to month, depending on how these things look. So, our forecast is for, you know, 0.2% growth, just a hair above 0%, but that could potentially be as high as 3%, or it could be 0%, or even negative, depending how some of these factors play out.
I know just recently there's been word coming from BP, which is one of Northwest Indiana's largest employers, that they may have to go to the International Trade Commission and ask for some help in getting some kind of exemption from the trade tariffs that are out there on steel, because of what they need to have to be able to do the work they want to do at the Whiting Refinery is going to have to come from overseas, not necessarily a product that's made here in the USA. Are we going to see, do you think, that maybe more problems like this over time, that we'll have more trade exemptions sought, tariff exemptions sought, rather?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the short term here, you know, the tariffs have increased the price of steel, which is fantastic for the steel producers in the United States. But over time, those higher prices are going to kind of trickle up the supply chain, if you will, into projects like what you see at BP, and they're going to result in more expensive projects, or, you know, potentially projects that can't otherwise happen without, you know, foreign imports. And so, you know, those projects may be less likely to happen. They may be smaller scale, or they may just cost a lot more. And so that's kind of the real long-term worry. You know, if the tariffs and this kind of potential trade war continue for a while, then, you know, we may kind of suffer some longer-term, you know, implications.
We're talking with Micah Pollack, who is a economics professor at IU Northwest in Gary. He's also, along with his colleagues, I guess like the co-author of what is known as the Northwest Indiana Coincident Index, a very long name and a little longer name still, for the Northwest Indiana Imputed Gross Metropolitan Product. These are all indicators of how Northwest Indiana's economy is doing these days. Now, I understand recently, Micah, that you picked up some additional help that will help you get to some of the number crunching and data gathering a little faster and a little more efficiently. Tell us about, first off, some help from Northwest Indiana, a longtime employer that's going to help you out.
Absolutely. So, you know, we were lucky enough about a year ago to get a nice grant from People's Bank here in Northwest Indiana that we were able to use to support one of our really star economics students to assist working on the index. And with his help, we were able to revise how the index is estimated. You know, it's based off of a model that the Federal Reserve uses, and, you know, they've updated their techniques, and so we wanted to adjust our techniques as well. And so he's been very instrumental in helping us, you know, kind of keep things updated and keep things more accurate and consistent. And then this was also an opportunity to provide him some hands-on training, some hands-on experience that he's using to apply to graduate school, and hopefully we'll be attending a PhD program in economics in the fall.
That's great to hear. A lot of people do help out. You do have, like you say, not only have fellow professors helping you out on this project, as well as having interns, I guess, students that are interested in learning how these types of projects are done, so they in turn maybe can get their graduate degrees, eventually go off and help somebody else with, I guess, a similar type of project too, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. And we really use this and everything else we do here as an opportunity for, you know, mostly mutually beneficial collaborations with the local community, you know, with our students, with other instructors. And, you know, the idea here is, you know, if I'm out and presenting in the community, I hear from the community about factors that are important to them, and these things can get incorporated. And it's really, you know, a process that includes everyone and, you know, tries to tie everything together.
That's right. And one of the other points I wanted to bring up, too, while we talk is the fact that you picked up an additional title, being as the new director at the Center for Economic Education and Research at IU Northwest. And a lot of this, too, as you say, not only are you helping teach people the importance of economics in the region, but you're teaching young people as well, too. Tell us how your new position with the CEER is going to help expand the mission of the center.
Absolutely. So the Center for Economic Education is a center that's existed for about 30 years here, and its primary focus was on providing educational programs and workshops for K-12 teachers to promote economic and financial literacy, you know, in high school and grade school classrooms. And we've renamed it a little bit, so we've added research on the end of that, and we're expanding the mission some. So all of the data series we publish, like the Economic Index and GMP, are going to be housed under the auspices of the Center for Economic Education and Research. And we're going to use this as an opportunity to look for relationships that we can build with local businesses, local community leaders, and connect those with students, faculty, you know, high school teachers, pretty much anyone that's interested, to try to build a stronger, you know, relationship between all those groups.
Well, it sounds like a number of projects that are underway right now there in the Department of Economics there at Indiana University Northwest is certainly going to help out. And these additional titles just are, you know, going to help expand what you and your colleagues are doing right now. If there is anybody that can take a look at all this data and put it together and try to make some sense out of it, do you think that it's you and your colleagues at the center that can in turn at least tell the rest of us who are not quite as well-learned in economics, we're dealing with our own problems like our family budgets or personal expenses, how in the big picture Northwest Indiana is really doing?
Absolutely. And that's kind of what we want to try to help with. You know, there's a huge need for understanding of how our economy works here, whether it's, you know, the entire region or your personal budget. And, you know, with the Center for Economic Education Research, we hope to kind of address some of those needs. You know, we do, you know, as much as we can, but we also need help from, you know, people in the community. So if this is, you know, if there's something that, you know, a business or a local community organization would like to collaborate on, if they want to bring a presenter in, you know, to talk about some of these issues and some of the, you know, economic and financial literacy, you know, basics, you know, that's kind of what we're here for.
Mm-hmm. And if anybody, I just want to get hold of you and your colleagues there at the School of Business and Economics at IU Northwest to get some help in the public about these, with him they in turn reach you?
They can reach me at my email address, which is mpollak@iun.edu. Or if you'd like to go to the website, it's go.iu.edu/NWI. Go.iu.edu/NWI.
Well, as always, Micah, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about some very sometimes confusing numbers, but some good news to know with how things went in 2018. We just have to be prepared for some changes ahead in 2019, and we thank you for spending some time with us to talk about it today.
That's always a pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
You're welcome. Dr. Micah Pollack is Assistant Professor of Economics at the School of Business and Economics at IU Northwest in Gary. And he and his colleagues helped put together two important economic indices that help Northwest Indiana figure how our economy is doing, the Northwest Indiana Gross Metropolitan Product and the larger Northwest Indiana Coincident Economic Index. These next stories come to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversation to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
A good neighbor is one who may not be related to you, but who cares about your well-being, who cares about what your needs are, who is willing to meet those needs, and at the same time, because you've developed a relationship, you are willing to meet that neighbor's needs. As a rule, my mother's parents lived in town and she had brothers and sisters who lived in town. But more often than not, I wouldn't go over my grandparents' house if my parents went out. I would go to my neighbors and would spend the night at their homes. You know, it was just like being at my own home. So a neighbor is also an individual who is willing to contribute their part to keeping the community vibrant, to keeping the community friendly, and making sure that the community is safe. One of the things that I think is important is to get back to that sense of neighborhood, sense of community through block clubs, through Neighborhood Watch, because the good thing about Neighborhood Watch is if you start watching, then you'll know who the bad actors are, because they're not gonna come to the block club meeting. And then so all eyes can be focused on them. When I think about Gary today and the perception that people have of Gary, a lot of it is based on individual or isolated media accounts. And so I know that people have a position or a thought about crime in Gary, about blight or abandonment in Gary. There are still some of those neighborhoods that exist today. Certainly my own neighborhood, even though my mother no longer lives in the house that I grew up in, her sister does. And she still has the relationship. We have a neighbor who's almost 90 years old who still tries to go out and shovel her sidewalk, and she has to chase him in the house. And that's because he's been doing it for over 60 years. And that's just what a neighbor does in his estimation, even though, you know, he's as old as he is.
Originally, the east side of Gary, which is anything east of Broadway. See, downtown was flourishing then. So we're going to say from 8th Avenue down to 5th Avenue was the business district. And then from about, say, 9th Avenue back to about 25th, and from the east side of Gary up to Broadway was black area. That was where most of the black people lived. And then everything around that. So you had the west side at that time was predominantly white, and Glen Park was predominantly white. So blacks were kind of closed in that one little area. And Glen Park, they probably started to transition about the same time, because we moved to the west side of Gary, and Glen Park was still predominantly white, because we were bused from the west side when there was forced integration to Glen Park and went to school in Glen Park. The first year I was bused was to Webster School in fifth grade. I was among the first group of students that were bused for integration. And the year that we were bused to Webster in Glen Park, we had a principal, and her name was Ruth Deverick. And she had two meetings. She called in the parents of the white students and the parents of the black students prior to school. And she said, "Now, we are coming together as a school, a united school. We are not going to have problems this year." And that school year went smoothly. And then they got rid of her. And the next year we had a new principal, and that was not his mindset. And it was chaotic almost the whole year. I often wonder now, as I reflect on that, was that the mindset of the administration? Because they had to know that under her guidance, there were no problems. And they moved her and moved him in, and he had a totally different mindset, and there were problems all year. So we went on from there into junior high school, and we went to Bailey, and it kind of continued. You know, we were in school together, but we were separated. That was also the year that Martin Luther King died. We were very upset about it, and the school system kind of felt, we felt like it was just incidental to them. They did not care. So we wanted some acknowledgement that this had happened, whether it be an assembly, even something said over the intercom. But they refused to do anything. They just acted like it had never happened or like it was of no importance. There were several of us who led a walkout. Now, Bailey School was quite a distance from where we lived because that was in Glen Park over on Georgia Street, and we were normally bused home. But we walked that day. We walked home to show our solidarity. You know, we felt empowered by walking out and saying that we are showing how we feel about the death of Dr. King, whether or not you feel at all about it. There were no consequences. You know, no one was punished for it. I guess at that point, it was like, if we don't talk about it, it didn't happen.
You can find more original stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. As counties across the state grapple with exploding jail populations, some lawmakers are looking at ways to give them relief. They're proposing changes that include directing more funding to counties and sending some felons back to prison. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brosier has a two-part series on jail overcrowding, and here, in part one, she explains why some worry that they're only temporary fixes to a larger incarceration problem.
Danica Kennedy has been at the Hancock County Jail for nearly a month. She's housed in a cell block that's so full, several women are sleeping on bunk beds in the common area. The constant commotion makes it hard to stay focused. Even the smallest of problems can escalate into fights.
You have people who get upset because it's a line in the shower, it's razor day, and somebody jumps in front of them.
On this particular day, there are 211 people in a jail meant to house fewer than 160. That doesn't include the 70 inmates jail commander Keith Oliver says they're paying other counties to house.
Last year, we spent almost $600,000 sending other inmates to other counties.
The problem extends well beyond this jail. A 2018 report from the Indiana Criminal Justice Institute shows 77% of the state's jails were at or over capacity. Police and prosecutors across the state will tell you the reasons are multifaceted. They blame the opioid epidemic for an uptick in drug offenses and violent crime. And criminal code reform legislators passed a few years ago means level 6 felons are taking up valuable space in their facilities instead of serving their sentences in prison.
I believe that we, as a state of Indiana, changed the criminal code, have played a big part in the jail overcrowding, and I think we should resolve it.
That's Representative Randy Fry, who authored a bill to ease the burden criminal code reform placed on local jails. It would allow counties to request the Department of Correction take in convicted level 6 felons if their facility is at capacity. The DOC would house those inmates in regional holding facilities that it would open in buildings it already owns, like shuttered prisons.
Well, currently, there's no funding in the bill for additional revenue to DOC. So the way we fund it now is that the $35 a day per diem that the county gets when they have a prisoner is then transferred to Department of Corrections while they have the prisoner.
Research from the Vera Institute for Justice, a nonprofit that aims to reduce mass incarceration, points to a bigger problem. Jasmine Heiss is the director of outreach and public affairs for Vera's In Our Backyards initiative. She says Indiana is an outlier when it comes to its jail population.
We're in this moment that's often talked about as sort of the reversal of mass incarceration. Indiana, in many ways, has been moving or staying in the opposite direction.
Heiss says no other state has increased its jail population so dramatically in the past decade. Dozens of Indiana counties are considering building new jails as a result. In Hancock County, some residents expressed concerns during a recent public hearing about a proposed new jail. Oliver says they need the facility to comply with state and federal requirements.
to allow for staff to be more safe, to allow inmates to be safer in our facility. This is something we have to do.
Voters here rejected a request in May to fund the project through a property tax increase. So now the county council wants to raise local income taxes by 0.2%. Greenfield resident Matthew Kofer says he wants the leaders to consider other alternatives.
For instance, rehabilitation for people who are capable of being rehabilitated, restitution to the victims of crime. Instead of just locking them up in the local jail, make them do something useful.
He questions whether building a new jail is the best solution in a place some jokingly call Handcuff County. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
And part two comes to you tomorrow here on Regionally Speaking. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. It's been 1 year ago this month that Purdue University Northwest has taken on the property that had been known as just a single property in Valparaiso, a very beautiful property at that, and they've been able to turn it into an interesting way to learn about the outdoors and to enjoy it at the same time as well. We're talking about the Gabus Arboretum at Purdue Northwest. And with us to talk about this 1 year anniversary, and for that matter, what is going to be coming up in programs at the place this coming year, 2019, we have with us Stephanie Blackstock. She's the Executive Director of the Gabus Arboretum at Purdue Northwest. And Stephanie, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, give us a little history lesson here. I think a lot of people may or may not be aware of the Arboretum itself. Gabus is because it's named after the folks who founded the site. Tell us how Damian and Rita Gabus put all this together and how it's gone on, and now it's within the overall care and observation of Purdue Northwest.
Sure. So the property has been formerly known as Tall Tree Arboretum and Gardens. Up until the merger with Purdue Northwest in February of 2018. So Damian and Rita Gabus founded Tall Tree Arboretum. It opened to the public in the late 1990s. So Damian and Rita came to Valparaiso from the south suburbs of Chicago. They purchased 72 acres of property, and they decided to preserve it as green space. And as they saw more and more development around them encroaching on that space, they purchased as many parcels of land as they possibly could, which has now grown to 300 acres.
Wow.
And what they actually did is restored that land back to what it was before it was used for agricultural use. So they rebuilt, restored a wetland. They planted a prairie. They planted thousands and thousands of trees. There's ponds. There are, as I mentioned, the wetland and the woodland areas. And then in addition to that, there are also formal gardens within the arboretum. And so those consist of two rose gardens, a native plant garden. There's a children's adventure garden area. And that area actually also has live animals. We have goats and chickens, turkeys, and bunnies. And we utilize those animals to teach children about where their food comes from. We also utilize the goats for invasive plant control.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll actually take them and walk them on leashes out into the property, and then they'll stay in an area for a period of time to assist with that invasive plant removal. So along those lines, as I mentioned, we have those formal gardens. And one of our most popular attractions is the railway garden. That's what most people know the arboretum for. And what the railway garden is about a two-acre area of hand-laid track with G-gauge, so they're model-sized trains running through that track. And they're going through historical landmarks throughout the history of the railroad. So there's educational vignettes in that garden that also teach us about the history of the railroad. And that was really a special interest project of Damian and Rita Gabus. So they developed this property and the programs that go along with it. Last year, as you mentioned, the Gabus family and the Tall Tree Board gifted the entire arboretum, all of its assets, and then the staff as well went with this merger to Purdue University Northwest.
Has it turned out that having the Gay Bizarre Breedom as part of the Purdue Northwest family has been not only, as you mentioned, about educational opportunities for visitors to the site, but also to the faculty and staff on both the Hammond and the Westville campuses?
Absolutely. Faculty, students, and staff on the campuses. And, many people are asking us what's in store for the future now that the Arboretum is a part of Purdue Northwest.
Yeah.
And the answer at this moment is sky's the limit. What we've learned in the past year is that there are so many ways that we can engage, that the Arboretum can benefit the university, but also that the university can benefit the Arboretum and the clients that we serve there. And we're finding that there are so many opportunities. It's just, we've just unleashed all these opportunities for the future, and we haven't even been able to pursue any of them yet. We have a lot of interest from the faculty. We're going to see some of them teaching our community classes this year. We've had free admission right now for PNW faculty, students, and staff, as well as their families. So we've seen quite a few visitors from the PNW community. And then we're also looking to have a PNW night at one of our concerts. And then we've also been engaging a little bit more with the Purdue Extension due to this partnership as well.
I was going to mention, yeah, they have to be involved some way or the other, because you can't not talk about Purdue University and not talk about agriculture, since, as we all know, Purdue University, at least the main campus in West Lafayette, was founded as the land-grant university of Indiana, and that's where, of course, agriculture has always taken a very front and center role. So there has to be some role, I'm sure, that if they haven't already, that the folks down in West Lafayette and the faculty in particular at the agriculture campus have probably found this a very intriguing project and might come up here and get involved in things too, I would imagine.
That's our hope. We've been in touch with some, and as you may or may not know, the Purdue West Lafayette campus is actually classified as an arboretum.
Oh.
The campus itself does have that that listing. So there are some folks in West Lafayette that know exactly what we do up here, and so they'll be great counterparts for us. This past year, we've really just been focusing on exposing what we have to the campus community. As I said, there's so many options for partnering, but right now we just want to make sure that everybody that is within the Purdue community and the Purdue Northwest community knows what the Arboretum has, and we can talk about ways to benefit each other.
When Damian and Rita Gabus acquired the property, first the initial acreage, and then buying more and more over time, as they saw how the area around them in what turned out to be the Arboretum was going to be developed, they were concerned about that too. Did their ideas, pretty much as you've been able to determine, fit in very well with the concept of the land trust?
Damian and Rita have always wanted the Arboretum to have an education, research, and a real scientific focus.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's concerts and weddings and some other things that we do to earn revenue, but the focus has always really been on that scientific effort. So partnering with an institution like Purdue Northwest really has always been in part of our discussion since the Arboretum's inception. This is not a new concept to partner with the university. It has always been the intent of Damian and Rita to have that happen.
Well, it sounds like some great projects, of course, and certainly in the works right now, and some great programs as well, too. Since the university has taken on the Arboretum this past year, what kind of reaction have you gotten from the public about the programs offered and maybe folks that have never, ever visited the Gay Bizarre Breedum before?
I think that we've seen actually both ends of the spectrum. We've
Oh, really?
Received a lot of questions about, is the Arboretum still going to be the same? Will it still have similar programs? And the answer to everything is yes. The Arboretum, the mission is still the same. The membership program is still the same. We still offer field trips for students and weddings. But one thing we have been asked, and I'd like to make clear, is that the Arboretum, while it's part of the university, it does not receive any funding from the university.
Mm-hmm.
So the Arboretum is still self-sufficient. We still need donors. We still write grants. We still have fees for some of our programs because we're still a nonprofit and we don't receive funding from the university. So I think that's been a surprise to some people to hear that. But we want to stress that we still want to be involved with the community and we still need that community support.
Did it sound like that some folks at the outset were concerned about the fact that, okay, as part of Purdue University is a overall property with Purdue Northwest and that it's going to be part of the university and it's going to not be part of the community anymore, apparently?
That's right. And there's absolutely no truth to that whatsoever, but it's certainly a legitimate question. We're hoping to see this engagement with the university just expand our reach and our programming and everything that we were already doing and just make it even greater.
Well, that's great to hear. Now, for folks that have never been to the Gabus Arboretum at Purdue Northwest, how can they get there from, say, Lake County or some other areas in Porter County? Come out to the
campus? Oh, you're asking me for directions, huh?
We'll say from Lake County in particular, from the urban areas, we'll say.
Yeah, sure. The best bet is to just head straight east down Route 30 because we're only about a mile and a half south of Route 30. So if you're heading towards downtown Valparaiso, mm-hmm. You're going to pass the Deep River Water Park, and you continue down Route 30, and you're going to make a right-hand turn and head south on 500 West. And you go about a mile and a half, and then you're going to make a left on 100 North. Our entrance is right there. We're right off the beaten path there. We have sort of a smaller entrance, but when you go through our entrance, it opens up to the 300 acres. We're working on widening that entrance and sort of having a larger presence there.
Well, I mentioned, if you're expecting the crowds to show up, and certainly when the weather gets better, people are going to come out. They'll want to take advantage of the great sights that they'll see there at the Arboretum as the spring months come in and the flowers and the other plants flourish and all. So we're looking forward to finding out. So it's worth making the trip out into the countryside outside of Valparaiso to check it out. And as always, we really appreciate your help, Stephanie, in explaining what the Gabus Arboretum at Purdue Northwest is all about and a good reason for folks to enjoy some green space, which is hard to find in urban areas like Northwest Indiana. Thank you for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Stephanie Blackstock is the executive director of the Gabus Arboretum at Purdue Northwest. We live not far away from one of the world's largest sources of fresh water, but according to an investigation that was aired on All Things Considered recently, the cost of that water has doubled or even tripled in some cases. It was on All Things Considered, and co-host Mary Louise Kelly tells us about it and tells us more about the report.
The Great Lakes are one of the largest sources of fresh water in the world. They run more than 750 miles across 8 states from Minnesota to New York. With so much fresh water, you would think that drinking water would be affordable there, but a new investigation from Great Lakes Today and American Public Media shows that for many Americans, there's a water crisis. They can't afford water, a basic need. Reporter Elizabeth Miller explains.
I'm walking around a park in downtown Cleveland, where the city hits Lake Erie. From here, I look out across the lake and all I see for miles is water. Miles and miles of fresh water. And if I look out a little farther into the lake, I see an orange dot. It's the pump building that brings in the raw water. From Lake Erie, the water travels through miles of pipes and pumps into the city's treatment plants, and it provides the drinking water that goes to every home and business in Cleveland.
They want every dollar of it, and it's just crazy.
But just a short drive from this lake, I met Melissa Thevenin and Dave Catlin at their home. They can't afford to pay their water bill, and they're not alone. American Public Media and Great Lakes Today analyzed the rising cost of water in 6 cities around the Great Lakes. Cleveland, Buffalo, Detroit, Chicago, Milwaukee, and Duluth. In these cities, we found in the last 10 years, water rates have doubled, even tripled. We found those steady increases can have devastating consequences for people struggling to get by, like Thevenin and Catlin. Their water's been cut off.
They want the whole amount,
$2,500.
$2,500 before they will turn it back on.
Thevenin and Catlin live in a small 2-story house in the working-class Slavic Village neighborhood. When I visited them in September, the couple said most of their $2,500 water and sewer bill comes from the unpaid balance of family members and tenants who lived here before them. And right now, times are rough. Melissa's hours at work have been cut back, and Dave is a roofer.
Sometimes he can work one day a week or he can work 5 days a week. So, and our money situation is just completely...
And we had no assistance.
Our investigation found hundreds of thousands of shutoffs to homes and businesses around the Great Lakes, including over 40,000 in Cleveland alone between 2010 and 2017. Without water, the things people take for granted, like flushing the toilet, cleaning, or cooking, become near impossible.
Most times we're feeding five kids, you know, a night.
From the youngest is 10 and...
to 18.
They've got five kids, plus Melissa's disabled elderly mother. They're buying a lot of bottled water. They send the kids to the other grandmother's house to shower and to wash clothes. And now they get water from their next-door neighbors. It wasn't long ago that Dave and Melissa helped those neighbors when their water was cut off.
We actually, when they didn't have no water over, you know, the past year, you know, let them use ours too and all that. So, you know, that didn't help. That was just more people, you know, on it.
Even if lending others water meant their own bill went up. For some, getting water cut off is the first step in a downward spiral. Sometimes people lose their homes to foreclosure. Some are even threatened by child protective service workers with losing their children. And it's expensive to have water turned off. In Detroit, the city charges $40 to disconnect your water and then $40 to turn it back on. We obtained 10 years of water shutoff data, and our analysis shows the highest concentrations of shutoffs in mostly poor Black and Latino neighborhoods. In Detroit, there are several local groups that bring free water to residents that have been shut off, including We the People of Detroit. Founding member Cecily McClellan delivers water every other week to residents that have called the People's Water Hotline. They call for a delivery, but also for advice. They need help to navigate the complicated bureaucracy of Detroit's water system, which can be overwhelming.
Well, I think we talked to you about that, didn't we?
On this day, she's delivered water to Reginald Newberry. She stacks five cases of bottled water on his porch.
Okay, well, it's emergency 21 day that they'll cut your water on, but you...
I didn't know about that.
Newberry lives on the east side of Detroit in his childhood home. He's 62 with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. Newberry uses the water for everything, from drinking to washing up.
Well, I wash up with the water, then I get big containers of water from my neighbors.
Detroit Water says Newberry hasn't paid his water bill since 2016, and they turned off the water at his request last February because he was worried about a leak. Still, even with no water, his bill keeps going up.
And then it was charging me for sewage and all that, and the water wasn't even on.
On a recent bill, there's an $8.50 charge for sewer fees. Every household gets charged for sewage. And on another line, $22.50 in charges, a water assistance donation. That's to raise money for a fund meant to help customers pay their water bills. Newberry's total has built up over years of unpaid bills. Still, it's a fund that should be helping him. Instead, he's being charged for it. Our investigation found the cost of water has been rising across the Great Lakes. In Cleveland, water and sewer rates have more than doubled in the last 8 years. Now they average about $1,300 per year for a family of four. Detroit water and sewer rates have almost doubled. In Chicago, they've nearly tripled. One reason the water rates are going up, there are fewer people to pay for it. These cities have lost population. But the biggest reason is the country's aging water infrastructure. Built years ago, the pipes and systems that carry water from the Great Lakes to the tap are old and expensive to repair.
We are at the Garrett Morgan Water Treatment Plant.
On a recent tour, Cleveland Water Commissioner Alex Margavichus explains we're walking over the city's oldest water infrastructure. There are two underground tunnels that carry water from the lake to the plant. One is 7 feet wide, the other 5 feet wide.
Well, the 7 foot would have been, I think, from 1916. The 5 foot, a little bit further down, is like from 1870. So still in service today.
Repairing old infrastructure is expensive. Margavichus says Cleveland is spending $25 million a year on replacing old systems. And customers are paying the bill.
When many of our water systems were built, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, many of them were constructed with federal support.
That's Radhika Fox, the CEO of the U.S. Water Alliance, a national group with members from utilities, local government, and grassroots environmental organizations. She says the federal money that long ago built those systems is not there anymore. So local utilities now pay 98% of the cost of a typical water project. In Cleveland, almost half of what customers pay for water goes to these infrastructure improvements. From Congress and the White House, there's a lot of talk about paying for crumbling infrastructure.
This important bill authorizes water infrastructure projects that benefit almost every state
in the country.
Late last year, President Donald Trump signed America's Water Infrastructure Act of 2018. It puts money into a system that provides loans and grants for cities to upgrade their water systems, but only $250 million for replacing and repairing old pipes. Radhika Fox says it's not even close to what needs to be done.
The federal government, frankly, has been just an absent partner when it comes to funding, and I think it's time for a renewal of the local federal partnership on these issues, because that was really what made for the success of building these water systems in the first place.
A report by the American Water Works Association, a nonprofit with members representing utilities and environmental groups, estimates restoring water systems nationwide will cost at least $1 trillion over the next 25 years. And without significant help from the federal government, older cities have no choice but to keep charging people more and more for water. For NPR News, I'm Elizabeth Miller in Cleveland.
To read more about this investigation, go to apmreports.org.
Health officials say teenagers are using e-cigarettes at epidemic rates. Lawmakers in Indiana and other states are addressing the problem, and so is the Food and Drug Administration. Side Effects Public Media's Araceli Gomez-Aldana spoke with Mitch Zeller. He's the director of the agency's Center for Tobacco Products about efforts to curb the use of smokeless tobacco among youth. And here's the conversation.
You have stated that your biggest goal this year is to reduce disease and death from tobacco. What are your plans to achieve that goal?
Overall, tobacco use, unfortunately, remains the leading cause of preventable disease and death in the United States. And this is cigarette use, smokeless tobacco use. And what we are launching now is an expansion of our smokeless tobacco use prevention campaign aimed at the most vulnerable and at-risk teens, and that's teenage boys growing up in rural communities around the country. We have a national smokeless tobacco usage rate for teenage boys of just under 9%. In Indiana, it's almost double. It's 15.7% based upon the last data that we saw. It's nothing short of an epidemic when it comes to teenage boys growing up in rural communities in states like Indiana. And the tagline of the campaign is simple. Smokeless doesn't mean harmless. Too many boys are walking around thinking, well, I'm not smoking a cigarette. I see my dad dipping. I see my uncle dipping. It's a rite of passage. And they don't think about the health consequences.
Can you talk about some of the challenges you're facing when it comes to electronic cigarettes and youth?
Not only do kids not know what the nicotine content is of e-cigarettes, there's a whole bunch of teenagers walking around, at least based upon the survey data, not even knowing that nicotine is present. Because the harshness of the nicotine is masked by the flavors. So nationally, we have an epidemic of e-cigarette use amongst teens, and this is another one of FDA's major priorities when it comes to how can we use the dollars that we have to invest in paid advertising to get the word out to those who are at greatest risk. E-cigarettes are by far the most popular category of tobacco products with 12 to 17-year-olds nationally. When it comes to teenage boys living and growing up in rural communities, the problem is smokeless tobacco. And we're going to also have an effort focused on reducing the number of boys that become smokeless tobacco users. But we need to do all of this together. It's a concerted effort.
This issue has received more attention recently from people and lawmakers. They're paying closer attention. Have you seen any difference since the FDA has taken a stance against smokeless tobacco?
I'm very proud to say that from our efforts through the Real Cost campaign, where we launched our Real Cost cigarette prevention campaign in 2014, simply being exposed to those ads has resulted in almost 350,000 kids nationally who would have gone on to smoke who won't. And we've done an additional analysis that we published last year which showed that of those kids that would have gone on to become regular smokers who won't, simply by being exposed to our ads, down the road that's going to save society over $31 billion because those kids won't become regular smokers, they won't become sick, they won't get the cancer, lung disease, and heart disease, and we will have saved the costs of treating those illnesses because those kids didn't become regular smokers because of exposure to our advertising. We hope to have the same impact on smokeless tobacco and e-cigarettes as well.
Great. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's Side Effects Public Media's Araceli Gomez-Aldana speaking with Mitch Zeller of the FDA. State lawmakers have advanced a bill that allows schools to charge for public record searches as long as they require more than 5 hours of work. Staff emails at school districts and charter schools are subject to public records requests. Under the current law, state agencies can charge for copies of a record, but not for the time and effort of doing a search. House Education Committee Chairman Bob Boehning has offered the change as an amendment to a larger education bill.
We personally believe that it was way too broad to say that no email, that schools could be sheltered from having to provide emails.
The amendment to the bill that Boehning is proposing puts the bill's language more in line with previous measures that have been vetoed by former Governors Mike Pence and the current governor, Eric Holcomb. The bill passed through committee at a vote of 11-2, and it is now moving on to the Indiana House. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. We hope you'll be with us tomorrow.